So welcome everybody to the land of the Varimadigal people, a map all of the line to a land called Cyber that is not magical or infused with the wisdom of thousands of years, but which was cooked up by billionaires so that they can trap us all in their delusions. But anyway, here we are. Sometimes that's the best we can do. All right. So we are just waiting for a couple of people to come in and finish and settle down here in Sydney for the last week. We have had a large range of Dhamma events. We had the Metta Convention and a lot of visiting monastics, and also Daso is here tonight, and various others have been around the place, and that's all fun, but so we're not sure how many people are going to come tonight. They may be dumbed out, or maybe they're extra inspired to not miss out on a single thing. I don't know. Could be either. Welcome. But anyway, I am here. And just as a reminder, we'll be putting the dates up on the website soon. But the last Friday night talk will be the 5th of December. All right, the last Friday night talk will be the 5th of December, and we'll start up again next year. So we'll be having a break over Christmas, New Year. Also, the lease is expiring on this venue, which is why we're finishing a bit earlier than we might normally. But we're starting up next year, but we will almost certainly be in a new venue. All right, we haven't yet determined the venue, but hopefully we will have one. We will surely have one. I feel confident in my heart that we will have a new venue. And I will let you know about that. So if you want to keep up to date on that, we'll post the details as they come to hand on the Lokanta website, the monastery at the end of the world.
And the Monday Dana still there in front of the Harris Park Post Office?
The Dana, the Pindabata is, we don't have a big Dana. That was only that one off. But I am going for Pindabata every weekday, every weekday, 11 a.m. in front of the Harris Park Post Office. So if anybody wants to offer Dana, that's weekdays. And on weekends, we're doing Dana in various places. Tomorrow, there's a big Dana in Burwood Park. So for any of the folks in Sydney, come along to Burwood Park there. I think we're expecting 30 Sangha there, something like that. So that should be fun. The following day, as it happens, also in Burwood Park, we have a regular Sunday Pindabata. So normally once a month, Venerable Prasanna and myself and maybe some others will do Pindabata in Burwood. So that's as it happens on the same day this time, and that's on the same location, and that will be on the Sunday. So if you can't make the Saturday, come on the Sunday, and if you can make the Saturday, come on the Sunday as well. Okay, is that enough? I think that's good enough, enough for promotion. Let us begin with some chanting. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dvitiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyam Pidhamam Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyam Pi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyam Pi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyam Pi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyam Pi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Iti piso bhagavarahaṁ sammāsambuddho vicaraṇa sampanno sutato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhirtiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pacha Vedita bhuvinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Nyaya patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Yadidam chattari purisa yugani Artha purisa pungala Esa bhagavato savaka sangho Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhirneyo Anjali karaniyo anutaram punyaketam lokasati. Okay, so let's settle down and take the chance to do some meditation. I'll say a few words to introduce meditation first. So when we practice Buddhist meditation, especially early Buddhist meditation, we settle our mind through applying mindfulness, typically by focusing on usually by focusing on an aspect of the body, such as the breath, and through that means the mind becomes clear and settled. And when the mind is clean and clear and settled, then it will see things as they truly are. So what we're aiming to do is to overcome the forces in the mind that cloud our awareness and cloud our understanding. Our mind has an incredible potential, a potential that we really just glimpse at. And the Buddha's path promises a way to be able to practice to realize the full potential of the mind. And when the mind can see truly, then it becomes free. So the Buddha spoke a lot about this idea of being entrapped, or being fettered or being chained. Welcome, Shika. I remember this one retreat that I did, and I came into the Dhamma Hall to give the talk in the evening, 7 o'clock talk, and I came in at 7 o'clock to give the talk, and somebody who was running the place there was there, and one of the students came. It was coming in just after me at 7 o'clock for the 7 o'clock talk. And so my immediate instinct was to wait a minute until they were coming in and then come in with them so that they didn't feel like that they were putting people out. And then the person who was running the retreat center literally waggled their finger at him and said, "You're coming in late again. I told you about this beforehand." I don't know. I guess there's two approaches to Dhamma practice. Anyhow, look. Just a message for people coming in late. I think it's amazing that anyone comes at all. So don't ever think, "Oh no, I'm late," or whatever. It's fine, whatever. That anyone to come at all is incredible. So we're really happy to have. For myself, I would feel very weird, like just sitting here talking to myself. I certainly start, start to question issues if that happens, right? So I'm definitely very happy to see some people here. Anyway, moving. So I was talking about the mind in meditation, about how we abandon those things in the mind that cloud the mind. This is one of the fundamental teachings of the Buddha, that there are these things that engulf or hinder or cloud the mind, called nivarana, or hindrances. But hindrances also means things that wrap the mind, like that shroud the mind, that darken the mind. So when we practice meditation, we learn how to let these things go. And none of this is like an accident. None of this is an experiment. This is a practice that's been done for thousands of years. So it's simply a matter of applying it and following that path. The tricky bit is that while that general idea applies to everyone, the particular way that we apply it for ourselves is very personal. So the way that people walk that path is going to be very individual. So when I teach meditation, I teach something that's general and that I hope will apply to the majority of people. But when you practice it for yourself, you have to see, and that's where wisdom comes in. So that's why at the end of the meditation, we always do a period of reflection to understand how is that meditation working? What's going on when I do this? What happens when I do that? What happens? And so by checking it, you are growing the power of wisdom in your own mind. Now, for the meditation itself, we're going to be doing some mindfulness of breathing meditation. The secret to mindfulness of breathing meditation is that it is both very simple and very profound. So it's one of the most common meditations that we always teach. Why? Because it's very easy to kind of grok what we're doing and to get started on the meditation. But don't think that that means that it's like a beginner's practice. Yes, it is a practice that beginners can do, but it's also a very profound practice. It's a practice that the Buddha himself did. When he became enlightened, and even after he was enlightened, when he would go on retreat, he would keep practicing that. So when we undertake this journey, and this journey of mindfulness of breathing, if you were to say, like, what is one of the most useful things, like one tip that you can get, it is trust your breath. Your breath is a path to peace and a path to stillness, and your breath will take care of you, and your breath will bring your mind to stillness. Don't worry about it. Don't get too caught up in methods and teachers and lineages and details and all of that kind of thing. If you practice a particular meditation, maybe I'm teaching a different way here, that's all right. Just keep doing the one that you're doing. It's okay. You know, honestly, the details of the practice, don't worry too much. What really matters is the attitude that we bring to the meditation. We meditate wholeheartedly. We put ourselves into it. We don't expect it. It's not like a technique that we do because we want results. You know, it's something when you give yourself to meditation, give yourself over to it completely. And the more that you surrender to the practice of meditation, the more that it will reveal to you its power and its potential for transformation. Whenever anything happens in meditation, and maybe something will happen, maybe it won't. But if anything happens, come back to the breath. If nothing happens, come back to the breath. The breath is your meditation. Anything else that happens in the meditation is not your meditation. All right? Anything else is not your meditation. All right? So don't worry about it too much. Don't worry if nothing happens. Oh, thanks so much, Andrew. That's terrific. Thank you so much for the reminder about impermanence and uncertainty and taking things for granted. But I just want everyone to know that we've got the lesson now, so we don't need it again. So if you have your phones, you could try switching them off. I hear that that is fairly effective. Okay. You know, I do kind of wonder about this, like mobile phones, you know, wonder like, is it going to be possible for any group of human beings to actually meet and have a conversation without being interrupted by the mobile phones? Is that like a thing that exists anymore or will exist ever again? It's odd, isn't it?
When we get the implants.
Well, when we get the implants, yeah, sure. Yeah, then that'll be good. You'll be talking to someone and it's like flicking through the pop-ups in you. Okay. So, again, to come back to the main thing I was saying, that in the mindfulness of breathing meditation, your breathing will take care of you. It's not about you. Everything else is incidental. You know, we can talk about like your posture, we can talk about the meditation technique, we can talk about all of those things, that's fine. But the breath is what is making the meditation happen. So what we try to do in the meditation is to bring mindfulness and awareness to the breath as lightly as possible. And it's that lightness of touch which conveys the mind to stillness and clarity and brightness. The lightness of touch. The more that you fuss around the breath, the more that you poke it, the more you try to hold onto it, the more you squeeze it, then the more the breath will retract. The more you worry about it, anxious about it, try to control it. But the more you let the breath do its thing with just you bringing very, very light touch of awareness to it. And you will find that when you get that touch, that the meditation will just develop smoothly. It will just go quite quickly, actually. And you can meditate sometimes for months, even for years, and feel like you're getting nowhere. And then suddenly you just, oh, yeah, that's the space I need to be in, and your mind becomes peaceful. And you realize, oh, yeah, that's the path. Meditation doesn't take time because it's inherently difficult. It takes time because most of the time we're not actually really doing it. We're doing something else. So if you can have the depth of surrender to allow your breath to take care of you, then you will find that it will bring your mind to peace. All right, let's do some meditation. So sitting quietly. with the mind at peace and the body relaxing into your seat. Feel the stillness settle through your bones. Feel the coolness of the air, the touch of your clothes, the sounds around you. Whenever your mind starts wandering off thinking about this or that, just be aware of it. Oh, okay, that's what my mind is thinking about. And come back to the peacefulness of the mind. And then take a minute to notice also what kind of mood that you're in. How you've been feeling? Angry? Tired? Confused? Joyful? Excited? Trepidations? See if you can be aware of that feeling. If you can name it, you can name it. If you can't name it, just be aware that you're feeling. So you leave the feeling be, don't worry about it too much. But just don't let yourself be engulfed by it. If, for example, if you're feeling angry or annoyed, and just take note, I got a bit annoyed with that person a bit earlier today. So just watch out for those thoughts of anger in the meditation. Or if you notice that you're feeling a bit tired, then say, just remember, apply myself in the meditation with a bit more energy. So this is you just check in on your feelings, because then that can help you to manage your meditation a little bit more effectively. Now bring awareness to the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing 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 out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. So now coming near to the end of the meditation, and bring the mind back into the sounds around you, into the sensations in your body. And ask yourself, what happened in that meditation? What was the breath like? What did it feel like? What did what was distracting me? What was obstructing? How does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, great. So let's have a break for 5 minutes or so. Grab a cup of tea, stretch your legs, get a breath of fresh air. Say hello to your friends. Time. Okay, very good. So how's it going, everyone? Fantastic. Everyone going okay? Anyone in need of urgent spiritual assistance? Yes, yes, yes.
Always.
Always, excellent, okay. Excellent, well, we'll call the Dhamma ambulance.
Is it a full packet or just a certain level?
All right, so I was thinking about what to kind of talk to give about this evening. And, hang on. So I've got a couple of messages online. I'll just read out them first. Dhiri Yupa asks, apropos of what I mentioned earlier about events coming up, will I have a retreat in April or around then? Yes, there will be a retreat next year, somewhere around April, May. We haven't determined the exact dates. The retreat will be at a retreat center past Broken Hill.
Oh, that's amazing.
Okay. So if you've ever wondered what it means to go beyond the black stump, or if you've wondered what is whoop whoop, then that is where we're going. We're going to whoop whoop. We're going beyond the black stump. Back of Burke. Literally, back of Burke. Right? So
Broken Hill.
Broken Hill.
Wow, that's a long way.
That's a long way, I know, right? Yeah. Anybody who's wanting to walk, then congratulations. Don't with Sinsin if you want to lead a walking trip out there. It's for those of you in it's for those of you in other places who might not be aware of this, but Australia is very large. Broken Hill is still in the same state as still in New South Wales, the same state as Sydney, but it's an 18-hour train trip. 18 hours on the train in the same state. It's closer to Adelaide than it is to Sydney. So if any of you have got friends in Adelaide, then it's actually quite convenient for them to come. It's also, I think, just as far from Brisbane or Melbourne as it is from Sydney, pretty much. So basically, you'll be out in the desert, and so we'll be doing a retreat out there. We'll give you the details as they come to hand. But, yeah, we've already been out there. Deepika and Radha actually went out there to look at the place, check it out. So it's definitely happening. And one of the reasons for doing that is because we loved our retreat in the desert a few years ago, but it's very difficult to get to Central Australia. You have to fly or drive via Adelaide or something. It's not easy to get there. So this is relatively easy to get, even though it's a long train trip, but you can just jump on a train in Sydney and get to Broken Hill. It's then an hour's drive from Broken Hill to the place, but we can organise that. So you can either drive out if you want to or get on the train. It makes it relatively accessible. Okay. Scott mentions implants. Wow, something worse than a lobotomy. Can the implants give lobotomies if you are a naughty non-consumer? I would guess that's probably like a feature that they will provide. Yes, if you get it, I wouldn't trust them to not do that. Venerable Dhammakipa says, Namaskar Bhante. My respects to you and all the venerables joining on Zoom and those in person. Venerable Dhammakipa, respects to you as well. Hope you're doing well. Marion asks, okay. Okay, Marion, thanks for the question. All right. Marion from France asks, Dear Bhante, I hope you are well and happy. You know, when people write these kinds of things, like you say, Dear Bhante, it's like reminds me of like the kind of dear somebody messages that you used to have in the paper. You remember that? You'd write in, you like for advice columns and those kinds of things. Not many people know this. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this in public before, but not many people know this. In fact, my first published work was a letter to an advice column in the paper. Yeah, it really was, yeah. Of course, you don't want to know about what I was asking advice for. Do you? Well, look, I was young, okay? I was young, I was stupid. Okay, so I write into the paper, they've got this advice column. I write in under the name of, so what they used to give is like a first name and a suburb. So I write under the name of Stuart Como, who was my best friend. And I said, I have an obsession with standing outside women's toilets. And I just can't, I know it's wrong, but I can't help myself. I just stand there and watching women coming in and out of the toilets. I don't know how I can make myself stop doing this. And so Stuart of Como had his letter published like this. Stuart said that like years afterwards, some forgotten auntie would come up to him at a Christmas party and say, so have you managed to deal with that problem we had yet? Or... I completely forgot about that for my entire life until Stuart reminded me of it a few years ago. Yeah, he didn't forget. Anyway, sorry. I am so sorry. This is a story of redemption, okay? And the meaning and content of my writing has improved since then. And I'm sorry to Stuart. That was a bad thing to do. I shouldn't have done. It wasn't the only one, but it's the only one that I can remember. Moving on. Okay, so could you please explain a sentence in AN 8.83, Mulaka, Vedana Samo Sarana Sabe Dhamma, healing is their meeting place. So all dhammas have all things, all phenomena have feeling as their meeting place. What is a meeting place? Is it similar or different to pasa or contact? I guess so. Would you say contact is more like a point where the meeting place is more like different lines coming together in a space, or is it totally different? Or I know I should be, and then Marion goes on, I know I should be more concerned with reducing anger and desire, but I'm obsessed with words and meaning. Marion, don't apologize. We are here to talk about meaning and to ask questions and discuss things of meaning is a beautiful thing, and it's great to be able to have the opportunity to have people who care about the Buddha's teachings. So, by the way, all those people who said that they wanted to hear what the letter was, you satisfied now? Anyway, moving on. Sorry, I'll shut up. Well, I'll keep talking, but I'll talk about what I'm supposed to be talking about. Okay, words and meanings. So this is very much a kind of an idiomatic phrase, right? So all dhammas converge on feelings. I think it's more meant to be like evocative rather than necessarily be a specific or defined technical meaning. But I think the idea is that the Buddha said that that he taught the Dhamma, taught the Four Noble Truths for one who feels. So one who feels is one who experiences pleasure and pain and neutral feelings. And it's because we experience those things that we have craving and attachments. And it's for overcoming that suffering that the Buddha taught the Dhamma. So that was my understanding. But like I said, it's an evocative phrase, which is meant to, you know, and there's a whole series of similar phrases in that sutta, obviously. So it's meant to kind of be stimulating and so on, rather than having a specific defined technical meaning. So that's that one. Okay, so for today, I was just thinking what would be a suitable Dhamma talk for the folks today. And I know that everyone's been going to, or not everyone, but a lot of people in Sydney have been going to the Metta Convention and to the various kinds of events and so on that have been happening. And usually what that means is that one of the things that can happen is you get very confused because you're like, well, this person's saying this and this person's saying this and the other person's saying that. So I thought, why not read the Kalama Sutta? Because that's what that's about. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. All right, so Venerable.
Just briefly touching on the quote the person asked about.
Yeah.
And that quote, are you taking dhammas in the specific meaning of spiritual teachings or in the broader meaning of all describable phenomena?
So Venerable Sadaso is asking whether dhammas in sabbedhamma vedna samosarana is teachings, or whether it is all phenomena. Not always easy to know, right? But I would say that generally speaking, the default sense of dhamma in the suttas is teachings. Most of the time when dhamma appears, and you think maybe it means phenomena or principles, and then you meet a clarifying passage, usually you find, oh, it means teachings. But of course it means the teachings in the sense that they are a description of the world of phenomena and the world as it is, right? So it's not just sort of the letter necessarily, but yeah, very typically that's by default, that seems to be most of the time it means teachings. Yeah, teachings of the truth or teachings of reality, teachings of nature. But that passage also is in the Anguttara Nikaya, and I haven't got around to annotating that yet, so who knows? Maybe I'll discover something. All right, so let me brief background to this. So the Kalama Sutta is one of the discourses given by the Buddha to the people of the Kalamas in a town called Kesamutta. We don't really know where Kesamutta is exactly, but it's around the, I think it's near the conjunction of the Yamuna and Ganges, my memory serves me well. And the Kalamas are somewhat of an obscure people, but the most famous Kalama is, of course, Alara Kalama, who was one of the Buddha's former teachers. And so they were one of probably a fairly small republic, probably governed by a democratic system similar to the Buddha's own Sakyan Republic or the Vajis, again, probably swallowed up by the expansive Magadhan Empire subsequent to the Buddha. So I don't know that we hear about them much later on. So that's a bit of a background to who these people were, the Kalamas. Actually, let me just double check the location. So if you're interested in where things are in the suttas, you can go to Sutta Central and there's maps. We both have both a digital map and also a drawn map. And that's intended for printing. And the drawn map is very nice. I'm just thinking if we have Kalama here. Okay, so Buddha is here, Mala. Yeah, so it's actually just south of the Yamuna, I think. No, it's just south of the... Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's in between the, in the junction, just north of Benares, near to the Malians, right, over the river from the Malians, okay. Anyway, sorry. Okay, I'll give you the link for the map over there. Already got them. Great, thanks. Thank you. All right, so the Kalamas heard that the ascetic Gotama has arrived in Kalama. There's a bit of a long passage there, which is abbreviated, but anyway, they went up to see him. Before sitting to one side, some bowed, some exchanged greetings and polite conversation, some held up their joint palms towards the Buddha, some announced their name and clan, while some kept silent. All right, so this is a very nice introductory passage, and one of the things that it shows is that not everybody who was talking to the Buddha was a Buddhist. And these are people who have different kinds of attitudes to the Buddha. Some of them are like very devotional. Some of them are like, well, I'm going to check this guy out and see who he is. And they're interested to see what he has to say. And I think this is really the main thing when coming to Dhamma. Like, I don't think we really care if you're a Buddhist or not Buddhist. Well, I don't really care. But I do care, like, if you're just interested to learn, that's the main thing. And if you're being interested to learn is much more important than, you know, getting all of the doctrines right or something like that. Anyway, seated to one side, the Kalama said to the Buddha, "Sir, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesamutta. They explain and promote only their own doctrine while they attack, badmouth, disparage, and smear the doctrines of others." Then some other ascetic Brahmins come to Kesamutta. They too explain and promote only their own doctrine while they attack, badmouth, disparage, and smear the doctrines of others. So, sir, we're doubting and uncertain. I wonder who of these respected Brahmins, ascetics and Brahmins speaks the truth and who speaks falsehood. All right, so this is a obviously still a very familiar situation and lots of different teachings in the world. Sometimes it seems as if everyone in religion seems mainly concerned about pointing out while everyone else is wrong. There's the phrase we have here, ascetics and Brahmins, is a generic term for general spiritual teachers. But in the Patanjali's Yoga, Patanjali's not Yoga Sutra, in his Patanjali's Grammar, which he wrote a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, he wanted to give an example of a particular kind of compound called a dwanda compound, which means two items which are placed together, one and the other. And one of the kinds of dwanda compound is where you list two items which are perpetually at war with one another. And then he gave ascetics and Brahmins as one as the example of that particular kind of compound. So this is giving an idea of the highly entertaining and dynamic community at the time of the Buddha. There's actually a lot of Buddhist suttas that talk about like debating, talking about, you know, that basically from a Buddhist point of view that we shouldn't go into a debate trying to prove ourselves right and prove the other guy wrong and these kinds of things. And the amount of teachings in Buddhism on that shows that it was obviously very much a thing. And it's continued down to the present day, of course, in Tibetan Buddhism. They still have the formal training in debates and so on and so forth. These days, we have some kind of interfaith dialogue or some kind of interfaith process. But we live in a world where perhaps more than ever before, it's very difficult to talk about other religions and things without being incendiary. And I don't want to kind of go into this kind of too much, but generally speaking, the example that the Buddha gives in the suttas is, as he will show here, is what he described as vibhajyavadin. So he's a teacher of analysis. So rather than going around condemning everybody or praising everybody, so sometimes everybody will be like, yes, 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 all religions are the same. Well, when you've said that, you've immediately erased all the particularity of any religions or spiritual paths. You've erased the actual things that people are saying, because people in different religious contexts say different things. The Prophet Muhammad said certain specific things, and those specific things are different than the specific things that the Buddha said. And whether one's right or wrong, we can discuss, but they're not the same. And so once we've just brought in this assumption to say that we're all the same, oh, Jesus is the same as the Buddha and the Buddha is the same as Confucius, I don't know. I feel like when you say those kinds of things, that you're placing yourself at a very kind of arrogant position of looking down on all of the other spiritual teachers and saying, oh, I know better than all of them, because they thought they were saying all these different things, but I know that they were really saying the same things. So I don't think that that is really a skillful way of thinking about different religious paths. On the other hand, we also see a lot of this kind of, you know, criticizing others and all of that kind of thing. So I was trying to follow the path of the Buddha, which is to appreciate and praise those things that are deserving of praise and criticize those things deserving of criticism. And the reality is that any spiritual path is made up of people, not made up of doctrines. Doctrines are just things that weirdo intellectuals like me sit around behind their desk and make up to justify stuff, okay? And we call that a doctrine, all right? But the spirit and the heart of a religion lives in its people and in the actions of its people. So it's fine to discuss doctrines, but don't like equate the doctrines with the people, and don't imagine like people are not kind of stamped out by the doctrines of their religion. Right? They're people are in a religion because they were born in it mostly. That's the real reason most people are there, because their parents were, or because they have an affinity, or because they enjoy it, or something like that. And so to participate with people, then we participate knowing that people are sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes do the right thing, sometimes do the wrong thing. So we shouldn't put religions and religious paths on some pedestal. We shouldn't be afraid to criticize where criticism is deserved, and to praise where they are worthy of praise as well. All right, so the Buddha then responds to the Kalamas saying, this is enough, Kalamas, for you to be doubting and uncertain. Doubt has come up to you about has come up in you about an uncertain matter. So this also is a very nice statement by the Buddha. Right? He's saying it's reasonable for you to be doubting. Right? So often religions will respond by saying, oh, you should have faith. Right? They tell us that we should have faith. Of course, faith is very important in Buddhism, but faith is something in Buddhism that arises from seeing the truth and seeing the path and seeing how it manifests inside yourself, and then faith arises. But Buddha's not insisting, oh, you have to follow this, and this is one right way, and this is the other way. Sometimes it's very reasonable to have doubts, okay? Now, just to sort of clarify this, because it's a question that come up, so doubt is one of the five hindrances. And I mentioned talking about meditation earlier that there are these things that tend to obstruct meditation. Doubt is one of those things. When doubt comes up in your meditation, then you need to set it aside, right? Should I be practicing this meditation? Is this the right way? Maybe I need to go and do this retreat, something, something, something. Maybe I should be eating a burger instead or whatever. And so that all of these things which are going to be coming up with doubts in meditation. So it's perfectly fine to set those doubts in meditation aside, right? Say, oh, it's doubting, okay, I'll set it aside, right? But then outside of the meditation, then we can reflect on it and we can inquire. And the antidote to doubting, as the Buddha shows here, is inquiry. All right. So the Buddha then gives a very famous statement, which has been often quoted in modernist Buddhism from this passage. Even though, in fact, similar passages are found many times in the suttas. So this particular sutta has become one of the most famous suttas in Buddhism from the 20th century. Before that, not really. It's actually a fairly obscure sutta historically. Was it Walpola Rahula? I'm not sure who originally raised it up and made it prominent, but it was kind of in the 20th century modernist Buddhism. All right. Please, Kalamas, don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, don't rely on inference, don't go by reasoned train of thought, don't go by the acceptance of a view after deliberation, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves these things are unskillful, blameworthy, criticized by sensible people, and when you undertake them, they lead to your harm and suffering, then you should give them up. All right? So this is the main statement of this particular sutta. Let's break it down a little bit. So the first thing is that the Buddha is essentially dismissing all of the normal forms of spiritual authority. Yay, that's great. So we don't have to rely on any of those things. The Buddha is not saying that these things are worthless. He's not saying don't study them or don't learn from them. He's saying that these things are not necessarily the truth. Sometimes they'll be true and sometimes they won't. So we can take them, but we take them with care and with reflection, and we don't abandon our critical faculties. So it's too often, I think, people think that the time to go into the temple is the time to check in their reason at the door. Let me break down a little bit the different terms here. So the first one is anusava, which is oral transmission, right? Anu means along, sava is to hear. So the anusava is the hearing by oral tradition. So in those days, from the origins of human culture, people would repeat stories, tales, poems, songs, and so on, and they would be memorized and they would be passed down in an oral tradition. And the oral tradition was still predominant in the time of the Buddha, and only later did it go over to a written tradition. So the primary example of the oral tradition in the time of the Buddha was the Vedic tradition. And the Vedas were passed down for thousands of years in an extremely accurate form through memorization. The Veda, the Rig Veda, is a very extensive collection of poetry, which is also not just a very extensive, but also like really difficult, like super complicated and hard, and with exceedingly abstruse language throughout the whole thing. And nonetheless, it was memorized and passed down through the oral tradition. And after a while, it becomes even so that the people passing it down can't even understand it, right? It's crazy, right? That you'd be doing something like that and you can't even understand it. Like, we'd never do that. Like, we would never recite Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama without understanding it, right? Right? Right?
Okay. Right, definitely. Yes.
Definitely. Thank you. Thank you. Good. That's why we have the trans. I don't know if we have them here, but we should have the translations. Anyway, so oral transmission. Next one is lineage, parampara. So lineage means basically a list of a line of teachers, right? And we find lineage lists in Buddhism. And we find them also in pre-Buddhism. So in a text like Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is about 100 or 200 years before the Buddha, then it gives a list of the lineage by which this knowledge has been passed down. And the Vedic lineages would always start with the teacher who's teaching that particular text. They go back to their teacher, their teacher, their teacher, so on. It gets very murky once you've gone like three or four generations, and then you get whole bunches of names and no one knows if they're really real or not. And then ultimately it will go back to Brahma. So Brahma is the divinity who originated all of these things and is thought to be the ultimate originator of all these texts. So Buddhism had the same kind of lineage lists, and we find them in later texts like the Parivara and other places, but they will trace the lineages back to the Buddha, obviously, rather than to Brahma. So this is the lineage. And again, we see this is like really common today, isn't it? Like lots of people will be saying, you know, I have my lineage is this, or I have my lineage is that. It tends to be, I think, perhaps less, would it be right to say it's less emphasized in Theravada? It's certainly very strongly emphasized in like Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, especially. Theravada, I mean, we have like schools and affiliations. I don't know if we really, I mean, we do have a notion of lineage, but it's not so formalized, I think. Do you think that's fair enough to say?
Yeah, it's weird. We usually just go back two or three generations
right.
of teachers, and that's about it.
Two or three generations of teachers, exactly, yeah.
Mahayana, they will try to trace it all the way back to the Buddha.
Right, and they've actually, and like, and in some ways, they've actually got the documents for that. Like in some of the Korean temples, for example, they have like lists of like abbots and like ordination procedures and all of that kind of thing that go back to like, you know, 12th century, 11th century. So they actually do preserve those records, but I've never heard of any similar records being preserved in Theravada. It's a bit odd, actually. I find it's a bit odd. Like Theravada had, you know, we have like the Wangsas. So we obviously had a concern for history, but we didn't really document the teachers' lineages. Anyway, so that's parampara. Our next one is Itikiraya, which I've translated here as testament. Itikiraya is a nice little word. Iti means thus or so. Kira means it seems, right? So itikiraya means so it seems, right? So this is, refers to legends, rumors, sayings, and so on and so forth, right? So again, this is again something which sometimes can be good, like a saying from the past or a legend, a story, a myth or something, but also sometimes might not be. Lineage, testament, a canonical authority, Pitika Sampada Nena. So this means literally inclusion in the Pitika. So this is one of the early uses of the word Pitika that we find in Buddhism in the sense of a canon or a collection of scriptures. So Pitika, in Buddhism, we have the three Pitikas, the three baskets. And so a Pitika is felt to be a basket, which is that which contains the scriptures. And so it's a basket of scriptures. Okay, so don't go by, those of us who like to go around citing the suttas for everything like that, bad luck, okay? Don't rely on logic, okay? Matakahetu, okay? So logic or inference, nayahetu, very closely related words, but taka means, taka was, or tarka was a formal study in logic, which was taught originally at the Vedic universities in up in Takasila. Well, they literally call it Takasila. Tarkashila is the logic rock. The logic rock. Be a good name for a band or not? I think it'd be a good name for a band. And so that was supposed to be the university where they were teaching these things. So Taka is kind of the formal study of logic. Inference, or Naya, is like the system or the method. So again, a similar kind of idea, but that might be more like your, so going by the method would be like saying, oh, it must be right because it fits into some kind of system that you have. Like a system might be like the Eightfold Path or something like that. So you might be saying, oh, this must be right because it fits into the Eightfold Path or something like that. That's the Naya. Don't go by reasoned train of thought. And so, again, this is similar in meaning. Akara parivitakena. Difficult to exactly distinguish these ones. They're similar in the same sense that, like, the Anusava, the oral tradition, lineage, testament, and canonical authority, these are all basically similar. These are like a sort of a text or a scripture or something that's passed down from the past. And then this next group is also similar in the, it's about reasoning, reflection, philosophical contemplation, and so on. So Akara Parivitakena probably has a bit more of a reflective sense to it, like a reflection about the reasons why you might want to hold a view or something like that. But still similar kind of meaning. So acceptance of a view. And then the final one is Dipti Nijhana Kanti, the acceptance of a view after deliberation. So the word Dipti is view, Nijhana is to deliberate or contemplate or ruminate, and Kanti means to accept. Okay, so the acceptance of a view after deliberation. So that's more of like a conscious sense that, oh yeah, this is what I believe, right? Conscious sense, oh yes, I've heard these different points of view, and this is the one that I accept, this is what I believe. Then the next one is Bhava Rupataya, right? So the appearance of competence. So these last ones are more about like the qualities of a teacher. Yeah? Bhava Rupataya. They appear competent. They look like they know what they're talking about. Yeah. The appearance of competence is exceedingly easy to fake. I can give you some tips if you like. I mean, if you're doing Buddhism, okay, so here's how to do it in Buddhism to fake competence. Okay, number one, memorize just one Pali phrase, right? And then you can just come along and just, you know, talk a bit and then just toss off your Pali phrase and go on, and everyone's like, oh, wow, they know Pali, that's great. Very easy, yeah, very easy. There's all other kinds of things you can do with that one, like a nice one. Is when you meet someone, then you can say to them, ah, we meet again. And they're like, what? What? You can read my mind. So all of those kinds of things. I'm not recommending these things. I'm merely pointing out that the appearance of competence is not does not mean that somebody is genuinely competent or wise. And the last one, Samano no Garu. So the ascetic is our respected teacher. The ascetic is our guru. So this is having faith in a particular individual and thinking, oh, that's, you know, this is our teacher. Everything the teacher says goes. So don't take, you know, my word for it. Don't take Venerable Sadaso's word for it, whatever. We try our best to try to teach as reliably as we can and to try to guide people and to try to express the Dhamma in a way that is meaningful and true. We put a lot of time and effort into that. But at the end of the day, it doesn't mean that everything we say is necessarily going to be the truth. And the over determination of faith in the teacher is a major problem in modern Buddhism. It has allowed a lot of abuse to happen and has allowed a lot of delusion to perpetuate because people can't question their teacher. even though the plain fact of the matter is that many, many, many teachers in Buddhism don't really know much about Buddhism at all. And I mean, this was quite well shown a couple of years ago when we had our little kerfuffle about the fake translation of a Buddhist scripture, the Matty Weingast thing. And basically, so this guy in America took the ancient verses of the ancient bhikkhunis and, loosely inspired by them, wrote a bunch of poetry, 95% of which was all just completely original poetry. And it was then passed off as if it was a translation of the original text, in most cases having nothing whatsoever to do with it. Occasionally it had shared a little bit in common with it. Passed it off as a translation. And look, on the one hand, who cares, right? The world is full of spiritual charlatans and so on. But on the other hand, you had this kind of list of basically almost every American Dhamma teacher you've ever heard of writing in the introduction saying, so wonderful to hear the inspired, authentic voices of the female practitioners and the authentically female voice of the blah, 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 and the voice of the ancient nuns speaking to us in today and so on and so forth, all of which was complete rubbish and would have been seen as complete rubbish by anybody who'd actually read the Therigatha, the book that it was supposedly a translation from. And so you realize that actually none of these people had read the Therigatha, or on which it was supposedly based, or probably many of them had not actually read Weingast's book either, which we also found out. So, yeah, when this was all revealed, most of them took their names off it, but some of them kept their names on it. Anyway, I have my separate issues with the blurb industrial complex. Generally speaking, if you want to know things not to trust, it's blurbs. Okay. So these are some of the things that, again, the Buddha is not saying that these things are bad in themselves, and he's not saying that we should not rely on them or whatever. He's just saying don't take them to be the absolute truth. It's okay, you know, we need indications, we need support on the path, we need traditions, we need a connection with wisdom of the past, we need advice from a teacher, we need all of these things. But we need, and especially we need to be able to reflect and think of things ourselves, right? But that's not the truth. That guy agrees with me. Okay, so then the Buddha goes on, these, when you know for yourselves these things are unskillful, blameworthy, criticized by sensible people, and when you undertake them they lead to harm and suffering, then you should give them up. And then the Buddha goes on to illustrate this. What do you think? Does greed come up in a person for their welfare or harm? For their harm, sir. A greedy individual overcome by greed kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies, and encourages others to do the same. Is that for their lasting harm and suffering? Yes, sir. What do you think, Kalamba? So notice how the Buddha's using this interrogation method, right? He's making sure that they're with him every step of the way. And it's particularly a method, I mean, it's a method that he uses all the time, but it's particularly a method he wants to use in this particular case because he wants to make sure that they're all on the same page. Does hate come up in a person for their welfare and harm? For their harm, sir. A hateful individual overcome by hate kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies, and encourages others to do the same. Is that for their lasting harm and suffering? Yes, sir. What do you think, Kalamas? Does delusion come up in a person for their welfare and harm? Harm, sir. A deluded individual overcome by delusion kills living creatures, steals, commits adultery, lies, and encourages others to do the same. Is that for their lasting harm and suffering? Yes, sir. What do you think, Kalamas? Are these things skillful or unskillful? Kusala or akusala? Okay, so you can see how the Buddha is now building up his argument. He's establishing them on an understanding, first of all, of greed, hate, and delusion, which are things that we can all experience inside ourselves. Number one, right? This is the foundational principle. We can see these things inside ourselves. Then number two, we can see that these things result in unskillful actions that are causing harm. right? Good. And then are these things skillful or unskillful? Unskillful, akusala. So the word akusala in Pali literally means unskillful. We often translate it as unwholesome, which is maybe also a good translation or fine translation. But I prefer unskillful because it's more Buddhist-y sounding, right? The idea between an unskillful act is that there's a disconnect between what you want to get out of that act and what you actually get. When you act out of hate, you think that you're going to vanquish your enemies or something like that, but you actually only cause yourself suffering. So similarly, if you act out of greed, you want to get pleasure, but you actually only get more pain. So unskillful something is something which has which, because of your lack of understanding, it has a consequence that is the opposite of what you think it should be. And so morality in Buddhism being something which is like decreed by God, or morality being something which you can work out philosophically, or something which is like inscribed in the universe, right? Morality is something which you observe and infer from your own behavior and own conduct. Skillful or unskillful? Unskillful. So blameworthy or blameless? Savaja or anavaja? It's blameworthy. Criticized or praised by sensible people? Criticized by sensible people. Vinyu garahita. So this obviously is an interesting detail here, right? The appearance of the vinyu here, right? So the vinyu is somebody who is sometimes translated as wise, but it doesn't even necessarily mean wise. It's a bit too elevated. Sensible, capable of understanding what's going on. Someone who has a awareness and a moral compass, really, is what Winyu means. Yeah? And I think it's interesting that the morality is not entirely personal. Like the Buddha started with looking at your own experience of greed, hate, and delusion, but it's not completely individual. It's also about what others see and what others think. And both of these are actually dimensions of morality, because morality is not just about you. It's about how you live in relation to others. Yeah. So when you undertake them, do they lead to harm and suffering or not? Or how do you see this? When you undertake them, they lead to harm and suffering. That's how we see it. So Kalamas, when I said, please don't go by oral transmission and the rest, but when you know for yourselves, then you should give, these things are unskillful, you should give them up. That's what I said, and this is what I said, why I said it. So again, just notice the Buddha's manner of teaching. He wants to teach in a way that is explicit and clear. Again, quite distinguishing himself from Upanishadic teachings, the pre-Buddhist teachings, which tried to teach in a way that was secret and hidden and hid the message as much as possible. The Buddha wants the Kalamas to understand. He makes sure that they follow him every step of the way, and he checks in with them. Is this how you see it, or do you see it some other way? So then he goes through again, don't go by oral transmission. By repeating the message, he's priming them to be able to remember it later on. Don't go by oral transmission, don't go by lineage, don't go by testament, don't go by canonical authority, don't rely on logic, on inference, or reason, train of thought, don't go by the acceptance of a view after deliberation, don't go by the appearance of competence, and don't think the ascetic is our respected teacher. But when you know for yourselves, these things are skillful, blameless, praised by sensible people. When you undertake them, they lead to welfare and happiness. Then you should acquire them and keep them. What do you think, Kalamas? Does contentment come up in a person for the welfare and harm? So the word I'm translating is contentment here is alobha, literally non-greed. Welfare, sir. A person who's content, not overcome by greed, does not kill living creatures, steal, commit adultery, lie, or encourage others to do the same. Is that for their lasting welfare and happiness? Yes, sir. What do you think, Kalamas? Does love come up in a person for their welfare and harm? Love here translating adosa or metta, or understanding translated as amoha. Is that for their lasting welfare and happiness? So maybe I should keep the negative forms of this and translate it as, does non-hate come up in a person, or does non-delusion come up in a person? Maybe. But we don't usually use those phrases in English. Yes, sir. What do you think? Are these things skillful or unskillful? Skillful, sir. Blameworthy or blameless? Blameless. Criticized or praised by sensible people? Praised by sensible people. When you undertake them, do they lead to welfare and happiness or not? Or how do you see it? They lead to welfare and happiness. That's how we see it. So this is what I said, and that's why I said it. And then that noble, so this is the main explanation of the Buddha's main thesis here, is how to investigate and reflect on then what is skillful and what's unskillful, relying on your own experience, your own understanding of that experience, paying attention to, listening to what sensible people say, but without necessarily taking everything as being gospel truth. Then the Buddha goes on to teach the four Brahma Viharas. And I'm conscious that we're running a little bit late, so I'm not sure if I'll be able to treat these give them the time that they deserve. But we will briefly go over these passages. Then that noble disciple is rid of desire, rid of ill will, unconfused, aware, and mindful. So this is referring to someone who's abandoned the hindrances through their practices, developing meditation. Then they meditate, spreading a heart full of love to one direction and to the second and to the third and to the fourth. In the same way, above, below, across, everywhere, all round, they spread a heart full of love to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. They meditate, spreading a heart of compassion and spreading a heart of rejoicing, mudita, spreading a heart full of equanimity to one direction, the second, the third. In the same way, above, below, across, everywhere, all around, they spread a heart full of equanimity to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. So this is talking about the profound meditation attainments of the four Brahma Viharas, which, as you can see, the Buddha describes in a way that is very evocative and very powerful, and it makes you want to go, yeah, that sounds great. I would really love to be able to do that. But you can see that it's also like a bit, I wouldn't say passive aggressive, right? But if you look at the, I wouldn't say passive aggressive, except I just did. But if you look at the description that the Buddha said earlier, that the Kalama said earlier about all the wandering teachers who are always slagging off the other guy and always criticizing each other, right? I mean, the Buddha's not exactly saying this, but he's kind of like, if you really have that metta, is that how you'd behave? Right? So when that noble disciple has a mind that's free of enmity and ill will, uncorrupted and purified, they've won four consolations in this very life. Okay, so we now turn to four conditional items. All right, which is also kind of interesting, because the Buddha's not trying to persuade them to have a particular view. He's talked about their experience, understanding the experience, understanding right and wrong, and how to develop that into meditation. So he's showing them a path. And then rather than saying this is what's true and this is what's not true, he's then drawing out implications of that. If it turns out there is another world and good and bad deeds have a result, then when the body breaks up after death, I'll be reborn in a good place, in a heavenly realm. This is the first consolation that they've won. All right? This is a little bit like the reflections that Socrates did on his deathbed as well. Everyone was like, oh, it's so terrible, you're going to die. And he's like, well, think about it. Like, if there's something after death, then I've lived a good life, so I'm probably going to go to a good place after death, so that's fine. And then if there's nothing after death, then I won't even know about it, so that's fine as well. So I don't know why you guys are so messed up about it. The death of Socrates is a beautiful work, actually. I highly encourage it. He got convicted at this sham trial for corrupting the youth of Athens, by which he meant he taught them to question those in authority, and sorry, yes, Yes, yes. Thank you. And so then they said, okay, they were willing to do a deal, and they said, what kind of deal do you want to do? And he said, well, I think you should give me a free accommodations in the main square of Athens where I can continue teaching the youth. So that didn't go down too well. And so then they're going to condemn him. And then some of his students broke in and they were going to bust him out of jail and free him. And he's like, why would I do that? You know, I've lived a good life and I don't have any regrets. If I were to break the law, then I would do something that I'd have a regret for. So why would I do that? Very interesting, interesting dialogue. Anyway, moving along. So the next one, if it turns out there is, so we've heard about if there is another world, but what if there is no other world and good and bad deeds don't have a result, that says no such thing as karma, then in this very life, I'll keep myself free of enmity and ill will, untroubled and happy. This is the second consolation they've won. Makes sense. If it turns out that bad things happen to people who do bad things, then since I have no bad intentions and since I'm not doing anything bad, how can suffering touch me? This is the third consolation they've won. If it turns out that bad things don't happen to people who do bad, if it turns out that bad things do happen to bad people, right? If it turns out that bad things don't happen to people who do bad things, then I still see myself pure on both sides. This is the fourth consolation they've won. So when a noble disciple has a mind that's pure, then they have won these four consolations in this very life. This actually relates to what we were discussing yesterday, you probably noticed already, right? Because talking about the noble disciple who is just wondering whether there's another life or not, which if they're a stream enterer, they wouldn't be wondering about. Yeah, so it's actually a good example of what you're talking about. So then the Kalamas, yes, that's so true, blessed one, that's so true, holy one. And then they repeat the teaching back and the Buddha. And then they said, we will go to refuge to the Buddha, the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. And from this day forth, may the Buddha remember us as lay followers who have gone for refuge for life. So this is the Kalama Sutta, otherwise known as the Kesa Mutti Sutta, but usually called the Kalama Sutta. And it gives a really nice example of how the Buddha would approach teaching for those who were not necessarily committed Buddhists, but people who are interested in some kind of spiritual path. And to show that his teaching was not focused on showing them why his teaching is better than all the other ones, but focused on showing them how they can let go of suffering. This is really the important thing. I did this interfaith event some years ago, and it was actually at a Commonwealth Day celebration in Canberra, and all of these people came up, and we were all invited to talk for a little while and so on. And because it was a Commonwealth Day, we were supposed to be celebrating the Commonwealth for some reason. I've got no idea why the Commonwealth still exists, but whatever. We're there, and I'm supposed to go, do you know what the British Commonwealth? Right? That's exactly what it deserves. Bunch of formal colonial countries which somehow decided to stay in a Commonwealth with England. We actually have this kind of organized, we do like games and stuff. Right? We have the Commonwealth Games, it's like the Olympic Games, but it's only like England and Australia and New Zealand and like what else is it? Canada, Jamaica, is it right? South Africa, not South Africa. India. Is India still in the Commonwealth? India, Sri Lanka, probably, yeah. I guess. Malaysia, still in the Commonwealth. So all these kind of random countries which only have anything in common was that they were all invaded and exploited by England hundreds of years ago, and which somehow decide we have cricket in common and a few other things, but that's about all. Anyway, so whatever. So I was invited to do this thing. So, of course, you know, there's this horrible legacy of, like, colonialism and imperialism and all of these kinds of things, but we're supposed to be doing a celebration. So I'm like, okay, well, I'll say something nice about the British Commonwealth. So I went up and talked about how the British colonialists, Cunningham and others, rediscovered Buddhism and put together the history of Buddhism by digging up the Buddhist sites and putting together the history and so on and so forth. and just talked a little bit about that history. And afterwards, somebody came up to me and he said, you know, you were the only person there that wasn't trying to sell his religion. You're the only person there who, like, praised somebody else. Yeah, everybody else was trying to convert us. Yeah, anyway, I was very proud of that. So you can see in this one as well, like, the Buddha's not trying to convert anyone, but he's trying to help them. And by helping them, actually, that's what they responded to. So this is the Kalama Sutta, AN 3.65. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Any questions or thoughts on the Kalama Sutta? Venerable Sir.
What are your thoughts on the phrase, in this way I am pure in both respects?
Oh, right, yeah. I just closed it. What do you think?
I find it a bit mystifying that there's several different interpretations which could make some sense here. So I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I think it doesn't mean... this life and the next? Oh, I have to go and check. I closed it prematurely, sorry.
The odd thing about it is that it's in a specific case of somebody who, in the specific case of there being no karma and no rebirth.
Right.
So pure in both respects can possibly mean the life and the next life.
Right, right. What do you think? I haven't done my annotations for this one, so I haven't got a footnote.
Yeah, I mean, well, one part of pure would be in that one is no suffering because one isn't doing anything to cause oneself suffering. But it's, well, what's the other? When he says both, what's the other in the pair?
Samaripasami, upaya neva usudham. So what are the two? So bad. I think maybe it refers to the bad things that happen and the people who do bad things. So the person and the actor and the doer and the result. So he's pure on both sides, in both that his actions are good and from the results as well.
One that just occurred to me is it could also be pure in the sense that one is not critical of oneself because you're confident that you're good person and you're not
silent, right,
but also you don't draw criticism from others,
right? Also confident in yourself and not drawing criticism from others could be as well. Good question. Not obvious exactly what it means. I'd have to go back. It'll be about a year and I'll get around to doing the annotations for that one, so stay tuned, everybody.
Another question, if I may.
Yeah, please.
I come from the United States, which is chock full of lay teachers who right. use exactly this discourse, well, the first 25% of this discourse, to say why people should not read the suttas,
uh-huh.
should not believe the suttas, should uh-huh. not go to Buddhist temples, should not believe Buddhist monks, and should instead just practice secular mindfulness while calling themselves Buddhist.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I'm wondering what your rebuttal to that stance would be.
So for those online who might not have heard of it, Venerable comes from this place they call... Sorry, what was the name of that place again? United States of America. I don't know. Apparently, but it's like over the ocean somewhere, right? It's like south of Canada?
It technically should be in the Commonwealth, but for some reason it isn't.
Well, we could say many things about America, but one good thing about America, they don't have any kings, so good on them for that one. Yeah.
We call them different things.
Okay. So, So this teaching, Venerable says, has been taken up by a lot of secularists who will then say, use it, don't trust the, you know, you don't have to go to monasteries, you don't have to study the suttas and so on and so forth. And it has been definitely sort of widely quoted and probably misquoted and misunderstood in, I think, not just, I mean, that's one context, but I think also in even like in traditional Buddhist context, it's often cited to say, you should rely on logic. Like, don't rely on faith, but go by logic. That's like how it's sometimes presented as well, yeah, which obviously it's not saying. So both faith and logic are also not there. So when I was talking about it earlier and I was talking about how It's not saying that these things are not useful and you shouldn't use them, and that, but it is saying you shouldn't rely on them absolutely. Of course, the sutra itself doesn't go into all those details, but those things are taught in other places in the suttas as well. So you have plenty of other places like the Vimamsaka Sutta or plenty of others where it actually does give examples of where these things can be done properly. And so they all actually have a role to play in spiritual life, but they're just not the final thing, that's all. Look, people are going to take the suttas and or take teachings and make something out of it that's going to suit them. I don't know. Yeah. May they be happy, I guess. Yeah, but one of the things for me that's very characteristic of the Buddha's teachings is it's always very reasonable, and it's not taking absolute stances on any of these things. And you know, obviously, like yourself and like myself, we love the suttas because we love them, you know. But I'm not telling everybody, you know, you have to read the suttas and study them every day or anything. I think it's good to read suttas. Obviously, I do the whole Sutta Central thing, but
I actually did tell people that.
You do tell people that they all have to read the suttas every day?
I tell them if they want to understand the Buddha's teachings.
I think it's good to do that, yeah? But I wouldn't necessarily be too prescriptive about it. I think it's good for most people to read the suttas a little bit, you know, and do it sort of gradually and contemplatively, but not, you know, you don't have to become like an expert or anything like that. And a lot of it really just does come down to personality, you know, and even in the time of the Buddha, it's not that everyone then was an expert in everything the Buddha taught. You know, often they might just know a few teachings. And if those few teachings are the ones that mean something to you, then good on you, you know. So, yeah, bit of balance, bit of nuance. I mean, look, let me just say this. The thing about that whole kind of secular Buddhist thing, it's very defensive, you know, because it's a lot of about like people who are trying to kind of establish their spiritual bona fides because then they need to, whatever, make a living or get some followers or something like that. And I think that generally people have a good intention when they're starting doing that. But I think there should be less, like there are ways of framing the Buddha's teachings that allow for those things, but without having to distort them. Right. There's no like these examples even in the suttas of lay people who have like large followings of hundreds of people, and so it's not as if this is a new or you know particularly innovative thing. You have examples like Cittagahapatiputta, the lay person who would invite the monks along for his dana and then grill them with all these difficult questions that they couldn't answer, you know. And so it happened, and it's not like there's this kind of thing that it's impossible. But I think that. My personal feeling is that scene in America is also overdetermined by kind of a reaction of repulsion against evangelical religiosity. People just loathe religion so much that they just sort of just don't want to have anything to do with it. So yeah, I get that. That's okay. Yeah. Australia is a little bit more gentle in that respect. I think we don't have religion's never been such a big deal here. We mostly just don't care about it, right? All right. It, in some respects, it really is very different. Like in America, you couldn't imagine having a non-Christian president. Right? It's not even. I mean, having a Catholic one is already kind of radical enough. But we've had multiple atheist prime ministers, and no one even bothered to ask them. Albanese, is he a Christian? No one knows, you see. This is Australian's attitude to religion. Nobody knows, nobody cares.
He's respectful in an interfaith way, I think.
Sorry, Carolyn?
Albanese.
So, say
he's
that again.
He is respectful in an interfaith way.
He's respectful in an interfaith way, exactly, yeah, thanks. Our Dhamma
he'll
friend
say the right thing.
Yeah, Jeff Gallup was also similar. Like he was kind of interested in religion and stuff, but not really religious. Yeah.
As a Catholic mother, and is from an Italian background, which is a Catholic lineage.
Okay, so he's kind of Catholic-ish, but not like really religious. Yeah. Anyway. Of course, good mates of most of the people here hang out at the Ginger restaurant with him. So for those of you who are not here, one of the group of the people from this group often go to a restaurant after the meal, after the talk for dinner. And one time they kind of bumped into Anthony Albanese and nobody recognised him, our Prime Minister. So was he Prime Minister at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was Prime Minister at the time. He's just like hanging out at a local restaurant in Little India. And anyway. Okay, everybody, we should probably wrap up. Thank you so much for your attention. So much great for seeing you. Hopefully we'll see you tomorrow in Burwood. And so that'll be starting, I think 10, is they saying the starting time for Sangha to get there anyway. And I'll be back in Burwood with Venerable Prasanna, and I'm not sure if any others for Sunday as well. But tomorrow, Saturday, Burwood Park, yeah. Tomorrow, Saturday is the big one, so come along for that if you can. Food stalls, everything, displays, everything. I don't know.
Same as on Sunday?
No, Sunday is very low key. Sunday's just a few friends. So Sunday is like a regular event we do once a month in Burwood Park. Tomorrow's a big way. Sunday we do every month, and just a few friends will come along and give about and have a bit of a picnic. So it's very nice. Every third Sunday of the month. Yeah. And that's followed by the Sutta discussion at Rhonda Place on Sunday after Alms Round. Doing the Apanaka Sutta. Really, Venerable. That's awesome, because it's actually connected with what I was going to do. And in fact, I was going to do the Upanishad Sutta today, and I didn't, so there you go. Great. Okay. Thanks, everyone. See you next time.
Thank you.